the Mayberry case.
Quick. I'm impressed.
And I would ask council to please sign in if you have not. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Judge Sanzay, and I represent Mr. Mayberry in this case. There are a few things before I...
Before you start, Mr. Sanzay, excuse me for interrupting, but do you desire to reserve rebuttal time?
Probably 20 minutes, and I'll...
Sure.
Thank you. You'll watch. I'll try to. Thank you.
Thank you.
There are a few things, I think, that need to be said in the background before we begin discussing what's in the briefs. I think this case points up again a reason for some additional funding for the circuit courts, because in this case we dealt with a sound system and we did not have a live court reporter. I know for most of our lives we started out with live court reporters in circuit court on all matters, and particularly on jury matters, and now particularly in a case like this where the legislature has seen fit to make a mandatory life sentence, they don't give you a mandatory court reporter to catch everything that's being said. And there is a lot of subtlety in the questioning of this young lady that's important. This is also the type of case, I think, that the legislature never considers when they pass onerous rules on penalty. And it's obvious when you look at the context of the case. The first thing that happens in this case is that the girlfriend of my client, who ultimately ends up having a different boyfriend by the end of the case, is the person who receives the statement days after all this took place, and there's some confusion about what day we're talking about initially. But in any event, she gets a statement which ends up being a little different than some of the other statements that are given later on. And when the young girl comes to testify at the preliminary hearing, which is done very quickly because my client is in jail and stays in jail through all this, she says that there was no penetration, period. And the Commonwealth, in that transcript of that preliminary hearing, which is marked as a refused exhibit in this case, asked the question, and they don't attempt to clarify, they don't attempt to say, well, haven't you said this, or did you really mean to say that, or what are you talking about? They said, well, is there any penetration? She says no, and they just move on to the next question. And I don't think they were surprised. I think the preliminary hearing testimony and transcript shows that they weren't surprised. And so then we move on to the trial in circuit court, and something that happens, I try a lot of cases during the year. I try probably 15 or 20 juries during the year. And I've never had this happen before. That is, that the Commonwealth calls up and says, come on down, we're making a motion to continue the case because we had the complaining witness and her mother in my office. And we had a big argument and they stormed out. And I'm not going to have a witness for our jury trial, so I need a continuance. So they came in, they got a continuance. They issued a capias against the mother.
I don't want to tell you how to do your argument, but I don't know how that really addresses your assignments of errors.
Well, I hope I'll be able to show you that. Just
okay. Moment.
I don't want to take up all my time on this, but I think it's something that's lost in the transcript of this case. So when the young girl comes to court and testifies at this trial, now she recants her second set of allegations at this trial. It's just like the allegations that were made at the preliminary hearing that were recanted. They say, what happened when you went up by the pond? And there's about 8 or 9 pages of testimony about that lead up to this point. She says, well, nothing happened. So I think it shows how important it is to get a statement, a complete statement, from the preliminary hearing before this jury. Because the Commonwealth's theory in this case and the way that they were going to present it, they say, I can put the witness on, she can say she made an inconsistent statement, and then we move on. Did you say before that this no penetration happened? Yes. Fine, now we're moving on to the rest of the case and the rest of the testimony. We're not going to hear anything about why you said that.
Well, counsel, isn't that something that you could explore with her and did on cross-examination?
Well, I did. I could. I tried. But I got a little ways, but I didn't get the most important thing. And that was the young girl says two things during the course of her testimony. First, she says, I was nervous, right. And that's why I answered that way. And I didn't understand the question. And then she tells me, yes, I understood the question.
Okay, so you she now said, have her being inconsistent five times, which from a cross-examining standpoint is a pretty good place to be in closing argument, isn't it?
It's a better place, but it's not the proper place. Because the question that the jury needs to know and that needs to be answered by the implicit is, what were the questions? You know, if you ask a question like, do you have a propensity to be in this area and when you were there during that period of time over and over, and if they ask some complex or convoluted question, you get that wrong. That's one thing. But if the question is, was there any penetration, and the answer is no, and then later on the witness tries to come back and say, I was nervous or I didn't understand the question, I don't think it's too much to ask in the case when a person's facing a mandatory life sentence. What was the question?
Well, why did, don't the rules permit you to take the preliminary hearing testimony and say, at the preliminary hearing, were you under oath? Yes. Were you asked the question, was there penetration? Yes. Did you answer? No. Yes.
I tried to read what the question and response was, and they said that I couldn't do it. Because she had made a prior consistent statement. So the Commonwealth presented that to the court, and the court said that's all we need to do, that's all we need to say. And if you say that, that's it. You don't get to go into it because you've already made that finding. And that's what was said throughout the testimony. She had denied that.
But your assignment of error isn't that you weren't allowed to do that orally. It's that you weren't allowed to actually hand up the transcript as an exhibit.
Yes, that's exactly right, Judge Russell, because I think that gets me to the point that's beyond the issue of discretion. Because I think now if the law allows me to put on a statement, then there's not a question of, well, you know, in my discretion, you've already asked enough. In my discretion, you've gone as far as you can go. That's sometimes a difficult place to be and sometimes a difficult point to get beyond. But I think the law allows recent complaints come into evidence. And I don't think that the prohibition against the defense, the prohibition that won't allow a recent complaint if it is not corroborative, is a proper prohibition. I don't think it's lawful. I think it's violative of our substantive due process rights, because if the Commonwealth can put on a recent complaint because it corroborates, then the defense should be able to put on a recent complaint that exonerates.
Well, except if it exonerates, is it a complaint? A complaint is alleging that something bad has happened, something bad was done. If the statement is nothing bad was done, is that a complaint?
Well, it can still be assault and battery. I mean, it can still be assault and battery. And it was, there's no way you can read this record and say that these weren't complaints about the alleged offenses of aggravated sexual battery, inanimate or animate object penetration. You know what the investigation is about. You know what she's saying in response is literally a complaint. And we say that you can't limit it that way. They could say that recent complaints are not hearsay. That's the way that statute should be phrased. Recent complaints about an offense or not hearsay, but not you can only use it if it helps the Commonwealth and you can't use it if it doesn't help them. And there is continued statements, there are continued statements throughout. There's a point where we go before the judge, and then on page 122 of the transcript, this goes back to what I was saying about the taping as opposed to the live testimony. No, Judge, I think you know the other matters that were raised earlier. I think we can just take them up at the conclusion of the trial, thinking that that has been recorded by the microphone that's up there in front of the judge. In fact, those things get flipped on and off so that there's not a danger of the jury hearing something over the system. We think we've got it solved, but we really don't, because we're doing things with the recording equipment. And in fairness to the circuit judge, he shouldn't be a sound man when it comes to these trials. I mean, he should be doing what he's supposed to be doing, listening to the evidence, watching the witnesses. So for all these reasons, we think that what the law should allow us to do concerning the recent complaint that is not hearsay is important in this case.
Do you have any Virginia authority for the proposition that when the witness who made the prior sworn testimony is there at trial testifying, that a prior transcript becomes an exhibit or can become an exhibit at trial?
It can if it's deemed to be an inconsistent statement.
Well, no. It can be used to impeach, but a case where they actually admit the prior inconsistent statement, transcript form
no,
as an exhibit.
Russell, I understand your question. No, sir. And the reason I think is I've never been in a situation where you weren't able to go question by question. And, you know, I think that this whole theory, this case involves a theory that if a proponent's witness has made an inconsistent statement, the way you keep that whole big inconsistent statement out is just to get them to say, oh, yeah, well, I mean, I denied it didn't happen way back then. So then you don't get to ask all the important questions, which involve the person's motivation and bias, which is important in this particular case. So I know I've got 23 seconds to get to my 3 minutes, and if I might just say this on the touching. That one, that the refusal of that instruction is clearly wrong. There's no way you can try these cases without saying that touching is important. And the Commonwealth introduced touching through a statement from a police officer who lied to my client to get the answer. And I tell people all the time, some people can answer questions better than you can answer. And when he was told there's DNA in there, how did it get there? He said, well, it must have been an accident. But when they introduced that, they've introduced a defense into this case, and we're entitled to a proper instruction.
Was that your defense, though? A defendant is entitled to a jury instruction supported by a scintilla of evidence that supports his defense. In this case, wasn't the defense that she was making it up?
But I don't think a defense is so narrowly defined, because I think if they put on evidence, convicting evidence, then anything that counters that convicting evidence is a defense. And I don't think you have to argue before the judge, before the jury, which you're not allowed to introduce as an instruction. So if the judge says, well, I'm going to give an instruction on that, and then you go up and tell the jury this is what the law is, you look like an idiot. So I don't think you need to be in that position. Thank you so much.
Thank you. May I please the court? I would like to apologize, first of all, that I had to rely on one of the transcript sites and did not designate adequately for the appendix. I apologize for that. I think I will begin with the jury instruction issue, since Mr. Sanzone ended up with that one, and come back to the recent complaint, assignment of error. And I would argue that the court did not abuse its discretion in denying this instruction, because this defendant chose to take the stand and chose to say to the jury, it didn't happen. Yes, the Commonwealth did introduce evidence in the case in chief that he had said to Investigator Dudley that it accidentally slipped in. But the Commonwealth also introduced to the jury the statement that the defendant said to Investigator Dudley she was mighty frisky. This was not the Commonwealth's theory of the case. The Commonwealth's theory of the case is they were alone in the mobile home, the girlfriend was gone for several hours, and that these offenses happened, that there was no accident, that these were intentional offenses. So the Commonwealth's theory before the jury is that these are this is an intentional molestation, and the defendant took the stand and said it didn't happen. And he was actually cross-examined by the prosecutor rather extensively. Well, you did tell Detective Dudley that it happened. Well, I was tricked. So you're saying it didn't happen. His testimony was it didn't happen. And so we looked at...
In general, can a defendant have different conflicting theories?
Certainly, alternative defenses. I didn't do it, but if I did, that may not be the wisest way to present a case to a jury, but yes, a defendant can have those alternate defenses.
And so the distinction you're drawing here is he could have argued it that way, he chose not to,
correct.
He closed the door.
Correct. And of course, if based on what he did, even assuming at some point in time accident was his defense before trial started, once the trial started, and once he took the stand and disavowed any accident, at that point, no one's theory of this case is that this was an accidental touching. And when no one's theory of the case is accidental touching, then accidental touching instruction is not appropriate. And that's what distinguishes this case from King, which this court recently en banc. I think you were almost dealing with this exact same modification of the accidental homicide instruction from the model instructions. But in that case, accident was the defense that the defendant had. And that is why, in my reading of the case, the court found there was error in not permitting that instruction. I put this in the brief, I think that after the defendant testified, the trial court would not have been inclined to allow the Commonwealth to introduce evidence to rebut accident, because at that point, accident was not there. And I will just remind the court that the pages of the appendix, and these are in the appendix, 87, 91, and 92, those are the places where the defendant said, I didn't put my finger in. I know it didn't happen. It did not happen. That is the evidence that he presented. He abandoned any sort of accident defense. And obviously, a defendant is not required to testify. And the Commonwealth used the statement, even in the Commonwealth's closing argument, to say, well, he always had an answer for everything. But the Commonwealth did not rely on that evidence. And actually, both the Commonwealth and the defense mentioned the statements in a closing argument. I'm sorry, the Commonwealth mentioned the statements in closing argument. But when she mentioned these statements to Detective Dudley, it was in the context of, these are the things that he said. She was frisky. It was an accident. The Commonwealth was not relying on that. I'll point out that even an opening statement from the defense, this is on page 10 of the appendix, the defense told the jury, and obviously this is not evidence, but even before closing, in the opening statement, defense counsel said that the client said nothing happened. So from the get-go, from the beginning, that is the defense the jury is considering. I do think it's important, and I want to make an additional point here, that really the only charge where this instruction about accidental touching has any applicability at all would be the object sexual penetration, because frankly, the other two offenses, the indecent liberties and the aggravated sexual battery, because there were definitional instructions given to the jury on what sexual abuse is and what lascivious intent is, both of those gave to the jury a definition which included intentional touching. The sexual abuse instruction did. The sexual abuse instruction specifically says intentionally touch. Of course, the jury did convict of those other offenses as well. To me, on transcript 307, it does appear that the defendant is limiting his argument about the instruction to the sexual penetration charge, although on brief it appeared that he was really talking about all of those. So this is the situation where it's our position that given the facts of this case, how this case unfolded before the court, that this instruction was not an instruction that was supported by more than a scintilla of evidence. And that is the requirement, and that requirement was not met in this case. I do want to talk about the recent complaint assignment of error. And I think it's very important that the assignment of error says that these pages, her testimony, should have been admitted as a recent complaint. That is the assignment of error that is before this court. And the trial court did not err in finding that her testimony in the formal setting of a court hearing with regulations and rules and compulsory attendance, the court did not err in finding that was not a recent complaint. I will argue initially, and I understand what Mr. Sanzone is arguing about transcripts perhaps not being as complete as possible. Believe me, I see those real often. And however, the difference is I'm not in a position to object if a transcript is incomplete or is incorrect. And the rules do provide for objections, and there is a process to have corrections made if the transcripts are not complete and are incorrect. And so while I understand that what he's saying, there is a mechanism for dealing with that, I also will argue, and did argue on brief, that really his argument is barred by 5A18 with regard to this statute is unlawful, this statute is unconstitutional because it favors the prosecution. Because at pages 258 to 259 of the transcript, he was arguing to the trial court that, in fact, the statute provides for it, or the statute allows for it. And so we spent time on brief.
But before we even get to that question, and it's one of the questions I asked Mr. Sanzone, the remedy he saw, that the transcript, the written transcript, would actually become an exhibit that would go back to the jury, I'm unfamiliar with any circumstance in Virginia law where that would ever happen. And so if the remedy he seeks in his assignment of error was that it should have been admitted as an exhibit, even if we find that the statute was, even if we were to find that it was a constitutional violation and that was before us, or find that it was a recent complaint, if there was no circumstance where it would ever go back as an exhibit, would we have to reach any of the other parts of the assignment of error?
No. I don't think that you would. I also think that, and I understand again his argument that he was not permitted to read ad nauseum from the transcript. However, he was able to ask questions. The court was very specific and very explicit with him in saying you must ask the question, you must have a question before her before you are reading. I think that it's important to note that so much was brought out in cross-examination of this witness. It was brought out before the jury that she had failed to attend another hearing, page 31 of the appendix. It was brought out in cross-examination that she had walked out of a meeting with the prosecutor at page 32. That she had previously testified that nothing happened, page 33. At 35, that she was feeling pressure to testify. 38 through 39, she agreed that she told the juvenile judge they had 20 minutes of wrestling and nothing more. There was extensive impeachment during the testimony of the victim in this case. And then during closing argument, this was a focal point of the closing argument, that she had made inconsistent statements, such that he said, transcript 283, the young girl has made several horribly inconsistent statements at 284. At a prior trial, she said the defendant did not put his finger inside. At 286, she's all over the board. 290, she's been untruthful several times. He was able to impeach her with this testimony, with her prior testimony. He used the inconsistent statements in his closing argument. But even in a larger picture, this rule under 92.268.2, which finds its way in the new rules of evidence to 803, is not unconstitutional, it's not unlawful, it doesn't favor the prosecution. The rule, as we noted in our brief, and it's rare that I'll go back and look at this kind of thing, but has its genesis from the hue and cry, where if the victim didn't make a recent complaint, that was held against the victim. It has evolved, it has changed, it has been taken over by the statute. And so that now a recent complaint can be admitted, it is an outcry without delay, which is unexplained. But as we pointed out on brief, unlike some of the other exceptions in 2:803, such as excited utterance, the details don't come in, and it doesn't come in as substantive evidence. It comes in as there was a recent complaint of this crime. That is the requirements that the statute, that the rule of evidence place on a recent complaint. So it's not substantive evidence, and the details are not introduced. And so this is not some boon for the prosecution to be able to use a recent complaint. And as I pointed out earlier, the assignment of error is that this testimony, these pages from the transcript, should have come in as a recent complaint. And the trial judge did not err in finding that it wasn't a recent complaint. There was a recent complaint made to the girlfriend, to the mother, to the police, and to the social services investigator. And I think that it's telling that when the social services investigator testified in this case about a statement that was made June 21st of 2013, the defense objected to it and said, you've already had three other recent complaints and this is several weeks later. Well, the preliminary hearing was several weeks after that, and so I would argue the trial judge was certainly not wrong in saying that this formalized testimony a couple of months after the crime just didn't qualify as a recent complaint. And so we would urge the court to find that the trial court did not err in this case, did not abuse its discretion in ruling on the requests that were made of it by the defense. The defense was able to use the inconsistencies both through impeachment and in his summation to the jury. We would urge the court to affirm in finding that there was no reversible error in this case.
Thank you.
And I'll try to squeeze it in, and I'll say that while I don't know of any case that was allowed the testimony to go back, it's not unusual in a lot of jurisdictions for statements to go back. That does happen. And I'd say probably half of the jurisdictions allow that. Lastly, the issue about the statute on corroboration, the reason the statute was changed, as I understand it, was because sometimes people would say there was a recent complaint, and then they wanted details of the complaint so we could corroborate. That's the whole reason that corroboration language is in there, because it goes into the details. And then the last thing I'll say with respect to the jury instruction, the question has to be asked, could Dudley's testimony have been the basis for the jury finding? Could his testimony that it happened accidentally after he told him, well, DNA was in there, so he must have had your finger in it. Because he asked him at one point, did it possibly happen? He said, well, I guess it is possible. That's not unusual response, but that's not enough to do. So the next day he comes back, DNA was there, how did it get there? Could the jury have based their verdict on it? They certainly could have. We don't have special verdicts. We don't know what the jury relied on. But if they could base their verdict on that testimony, then we're entitled to instruction on it, because it is a defense to the whole panoply of what happened. We have to have an argument that focuses in on certain things, and in this case, we focused as best we could. But we asked for an instruction because we thought if the jury was going to base its verdict on that piece of evidence, that they needed to know all of the law that piece of it. So thank you for letting me be here tonight.
Thank you, Mr. Sanzo. We'll come down and greet counsel.